Hello and welcome to Rock and Roll Politics, the podcast with me, Steve Richards. Thank you for tuning in. And, well, as ever, we've got a lot to reflect on. Today, there was, even before the departure of Hamza Yousef, we had such a range of themes to explore in our time together. But I'm going to obviously focus on his resignation and what that tells us really about leadership and the combination of qualities required and a context in which to flourish or sink. And it has wider application, I think. But there is, of course, a specific challenge for any SNP leader in Scotland, and that is to keep the sense that independence is looming one way or another. Anyway, we'll explore all of that in a moment. Beforehand, oh yeah, of course, some of your brilliant questions to come as well. But just before all of that, a reminder, we're in election week. Election weeks are always exciting for us lot, you know, those of us gripped by politics. And of course, these local elections, there's also a by-election, the mayoral elections, acquire a greater sense of urgency when a general election is looming. So if you subscribe to Patreon, on Friday, we gather live to review the situation at 5 p.m. on Friday. Not all the results will be in, but a lot will be, including the result of the by-election. And we'll make sense of it all. This is the last big electoral test before the general election. Where does it leave Sunak? Where does it leave Starmer? What about the local outcomes? Are the local issues that are determining some outcomes? What does it tell us about the general election? So yeah, lots to make sense of live. If you subscribe to Patreon, there will be a link there. Click on it at 5 o'clock and we'll all gather together at another moment of political drama. And that will be a moving story as well. And to gather physically, please book King's Place live July the 10th. I'm calling it the pre-election special, but who knows? It might be an election campaign special, but I doubt that very much. I think the election still will be in the autumn. So that's a live event. Tickets available now. Please come along for some fun and to delve really deep. So those are a couple of notes. I could go on. There are other things happening. I'm actually speaking at the Stratford upon Avon Book Festival at 7 o'clock on Thursday night. So once you've voted, come along to the Stratford Book Festival. Yeah, lots happening, but we've got to get on. We've got to get on. And here are a few thoughts. The forced departure of Hamza Yousef is partly about the immediate, the clumsy way in which he severed the formal ties with the Greens, and a general sense that, as it's a sort of clumsy cliche, really, it's applied to Sunak as well, that he wasn't very good at politics. However, we can get much greater clarity when looking at what happened with his two predecessors, who were, in their different ways, both brilliant at politics, but also acquired the leadership in benevolent circumstances, especially Nicola Sturgeon, for reasons that I'll explain in a moment. The great political artist for the SNP was Alex Salmond, because as he rose to become First Minister, first without an overall majority, and then with one, it wasn't inevitable, that rise. The disillusionment with the New Labour government at Westminster inevitably helped him. But it wasn't inevitable, and indeed in the build-up to the 2015 general election, the UK general election, the leader of the UK Labour Party, Ed Miliband, had no idea that Labour was going to be wiped out to the degree it was in the 2015 election in Scotland. And that was partly down to Salmond's inventiveness. He handled the period when he was first minister without an overall majority, with great guile and skill. I remember him telling me that he spent a lot of time identifying areas where you could make real change as first minister without the need for legislation. And where there was a need for legislation, he worked hard at making sure he prevailed. He told me that his model as a leader was Harold Wilson, the UK Labour leader, who I reflected on in a recent podcast in a slightly different context. As someone who Salmond recognised could wriggle his way around very tight political situations with great skill and emerge at the other end victorious. And Salmond did this, but also was able to address very precisely, and this is compulsory for an SNP leader, the hope that they will achieve the dream that binds that party together, independence for Scotland. Because Cameron, perhaps he had to, due to the electoral success of the SNP under Salmond in Scotland, granted that referendum. A referendum that meant independence was possible. The raison d'etre of the SNP had a precise mechanism to work towards, the referendum. So all of that meant that Salmond was on a roll. He was clever enough to create an aura of authority around the period he was first minister. And he had a referendum. And he manipulated the far too casual David Cameron, the Westminster Prime Minister, very cleverly, making the vote for independence, the yes vote in itself, quite a clever and important part of a mechanism for referendum. Who gets the positive sounding choice? And Cameron gave that to Salmond, along with quite a lot else, actually. So throughout his time in that phase of his leadership, Salmond was on a roll. And the art of leadership, and it is in a way artistry, is to cast a spell over the media and the wider electorate that you are all commanding and personify the future. That for any sense of what happens next, you have to turn to the commanding leader. And it's bizarre because, of course, they don't talk to each other now, but Salmond departed at the perfect moment for Nicola Sturgeon to come in and meet the various complex criteria of being a leader of a party seeking independence. If you remember, Salmond resigned immediately after that 2014 referendum and did so as Cameron again gave a massive helping hand to the SNP. The day after the referendum, once the polls had safely closed, Cameron popped up to announce he was changing the arrangements in the House of Commons at Westminster. And there would, from now on, be English votes for English legislation, changing the rules once the polls are closed in terms of England's relationship with Scotland. And parts of Scotland that had voted for the status quo were as angry as those who had voted for independence. They felt they had been conned. And I remember going on to Radio Scotland, BBC Radio Scotland, on the Saturday. Cameron made this announcement on the Friday after the referendum. It went on the Saturday. And I was just down the line in London, but producers and studio managers were saying, God, Steve, people are apoplectic in Scotland about this. And it was at this moment that Nicola Sturgeon took over. Membership applications for the SNP soared. And she had, without uttering a word, one of the magic ingredients of leadership, momentum. Membership was soaring, and so it continued. Now, that was the benevolent starting point, a voluntary resignation, that helps, Salmond going voluntarily. She getting it, total disillusionment with Cameron and therefore, in a way, English politics. But of course, she added to it by being a brilliant communicator and piling on votes, 2015 general election, slaughter of Labour, SNP soaring. And that continued and continued. Of course, there was that famous image of her on the night of the 2019 general election, sort of leaping with joy as she heard that the Lib Dem leader, Joe Swinson, had lost her Scottish constituency. And that was another triumphant set of elections for her. She was a commanding winner. And being seen as a winner gives the leader of the winning formula a capacity to cast a spell, to seem omnipotent, always relevant, always in control, and always with the sense that the future belongs to them. And it feeds on itself. So when Nicola Sturgeon was at her peak, she could do no wrong. You can see it now with Keir Starmer to some extent, and the opposite with Rishi Sunak. Keir Starmer, miles ahead in the polls, is treated with a new sense of relevance and respect and curiosity compared with the time when people thought, well, maybe he's never going to get into number 10 early in his leadership. And you could tell that, for example, when they made Labour last week their announcement on railways. It was treated like a government announcement. The Shadow Transport spokeswoman, Lou Hague, 10 past 8 on the Today programme. Her press conference was played live on 5 Live and on the rolling news television channels, almost as if they were already in government. Because of those opinion poll leads, the by-election wins, a sense of momentum. And suddenly Starmer, who spent years being asked, are you boring, is being treated as the next prime minister. And that treatment too feeds on itself. And this is what Sturgeon enjoyed for a long time. But when she resigned, and there's been a lot of talk since, or did she resign because she knew all these troubles were going to erupt with her husband and all the rest of it? No doubt, who knows whether that was part of the many calculations a leader makes when they come to make the huge decision to go voluntarily. There are many calculations always when a leader resigns. When they're forced out, it's straightforward. They don't want to go. But to decide to go when you don't have to is a huge decision. But it's forgotten now, really. But one of the problems she was having in the build-up to the period when she resigned, you know, all sorts of things going on, her attitude about trans and all these kind of things played their part. But she was struggling to show that she had a route towards independence, something that Salmond never appeared to struggle with because he had the looming prospect of that referendum in 2014. And if you remember, in the build-up to her resignation, Nicola Sturgeon was saying that the next UK general election would be seen as a referendum. She had already, on independence, she had already tried to get a legal backing for an independence referendum authorised within Scotland. She must have known that that was almost certainly not going to be accepted. And she must have hoped that if it hadn't been accepted, there would be a sense of anger in Scotland that would fuel support for the SNP. But in a way, it did something different. It raised the question, well, if not through that route, how? Given that Starmer says he's not going to do a referendum, Sunak's not going to do a referendum, how? And she was going to propose, Nicola Sturgeon, that the British general election and the votes cast in Scotland would be treated as a referendum on independence. And she was going to put that to the SNP's conference, and she never got to that point. It was deeply contentious and raised a thousand different questions about whether you could extrapolate for an election for a Westminster Parliament a decisive verdict on independence. But clearly she could see no other route through. And this, I think, was the fundamental problem for Hamza Yousaf. It wasn't his only fundamental problem. But if you are an SNP leader and cannot address this issue, you're doomed, it seems to me. And at no point did it appear that he had a device, a policy, that was going to move independence closer. And so, in a way, he was already, irrespective of the context, and we'll come on to that in a moment, stuttering. And stuttering in a way that would, in the end, lead to his doom. Because this is the binding cause of the SNP. You have a left-wing section of the SNP. You have some on the right. But you combine them all together, A, if you appear successful and electorally mighty, but B, if you seem to have a plan for independence. And then that papers over all the cracks. See, I think if Nicola Sturgeon had more space at the moment to be more frank about herself and her politics, it will become even clearer that she was a figure on the left of the SNP, quite a way to the left on the SNP. And I hope over time she will be able to do that. She's writing her memoirs, and I think they will be interesting on many levels. But her politics were on the left, but she had to some extent, play that down to bind in the right. And she bound them all together because she was a winner who seemed, at least early on, to have momentum towards independence. And that kept her going until it didn't. And it didn't when she was making increasingly desperate attempts to keep this independence thing going. And her successor didn't even make the desperate attempts. Now, that is partly down to his lack of dynamic charisma, political know-how. He always came across to me as an extremely decent guy, and in a different context might have been quite an appealing person, considered, thoughtful, very open about things like dealing with depression, clearly reasonable, although you could see the stress was getting to him because a reasonable guy was starting to, you know, the way he broke off this relationship with the Greens and dealt with some people showed, I think, that he was beginning to lose it. But anyway, those were part of the reasons why. But there was something else. What is the route to independence? And I hear no clear route. Now, Alex Salmond is very interesting because he is a leaderly figure and always gives the impression of agency, of being in control. He was doing it at the weekend when he was sort of laying out the conditions for his party and Alaba and his party's MP holding the balance of power, what their demands would be. Agency, agency. And of course, Alex Salmond has, it was his criticism of Nicola Sturgeon too, wants a more robust position on independence. But again, how? Even someone as masterful as him, but incidentally pretty impotent at the moment, he's not in the Westminster Parliament or the Scottish Parliament, the mechanism isn't very clear. And the context for Hamza Yousaf, and therefore his successor, is much less promising than the Nicola Sturgeon one. You know, people up in arms about what Cameron did after the referendum. There was a kind of anticlimactic feeling after the referendum. Oh, it's the status quo with that mad lot in England. But that isn't the kind of fluid situation now, where it looks as if there could be a Labour government at Westminster. So you haven't got the sort of that great recruiting sergeant, Boris Johnson, on the rampage, although I think in England it is underestimated how weird and reactionary a lot of its politics still is when viewed from Scotland and indeed viewed from lots of other places too. And I think is one of the reasons why support for independence has remained quite steady, even as the vehicle for it, the SNP, has been plunged into one crisis after another. And so without that, at least appearance of clarity of the route towards independence, a leader is in trouble. And obviously he was in trouble almost right away because of the tricky inheritance. These two giant leaders of the SNP had both been plunged into turmoil once they had resigned in very different ways, which changed the way they were viewed in some quarters. And then there's the other factor, which is that the Scottish Labour Party under Anna Sawa is far more strategically intelligent and thoughtful, and therefore a more formidable opponent than when it was in the doldrums, traumatized by its sudden and dramatic decline from being the dominant force in Scotland to being this puny, pathetic, confused, bewildered party. Now, whoever takes over the SNP faces a Scottish Labour Party that is has a good presenter and a good communicator in Anna Sawa, but also someone constantly thinking strategically. He knows it's obviously better for Scottish Labour if there's a prospect of a Labour government at Westminster, but he knows of the dangers too. So already I know that he's thinking ahead about how he, as a leader of Scottish Labour in the build-up to the elections for the Scottish Parliament, must show the opportunities that delivers Scotland, but also to choose the moments where he and his party, the Scottish Labour Party, is distinct from the Westminster government being led by Keir Starmer. He's already had to do it when Starmer's aides pursue that sort of dated New Labour strategy of praising Thatcher and other sort of crude techniques. He's had to come up and distance himself, as he has to some extent with the horrors going on in Gaza and the Westminster Labour position he has sometimes been distinctive from. Now, that is a challenge for whoever takes over the SNP, because the SNP is now the party on the defensive. You know, this leader has not been around for very long, and he has gone. And when leaders, as the Tories at Westminster have shown, come and go on a regular basis and go in traumatic circumstances, it's always a symptom of something wider. And we will now have a leadership contest, which will again highlight some of the internal tensions. And it is possible, for example, who knows if they, I don't know what Kate Forbes is going to do as I record this, but she is far more articulate and compelling than Hamza Youssef, who is, say, a sort of nice bloke. But I noticed, I watched his last, well, it's not going to be his last, he's not going until a successor is elected. But First Minister's Questions before he announced this last week. And he's just not, he had his head down when he was speaking. He was a poor communicator, and she's a rather compelling one. But as was famously shown in the last leadership contest, she is a figure on the economic and social right of her party. And that's a perfectly legitimate position for someone to be in. But as a leader, you have to be, if you lead the SNP, even more skillful, a binder of different wings than if you lead these other parties, you know, the Tories, Labour or whatever, which are, and indeed the Lib Dems, which have deep, deep divisions. So let's see. But I think the context and the ultimate mission make it a really challenging party to lead at the moment. And as I say, the contrast, the most vivid contrast, is compared with when Nicola Sturgeon took over, when it really was the dream, as membership applications were pouring into the SNP office after that referendum and Cameron's pathetic tricksiness in response. That was the dream. She did it brilliantly. She responded to, it could have all still gone wrong, but she turned it into a real opportunity for the SNP. But now the context is so much more challenging for them. And what is the route to independence? I can't see it at the moment. Now, I fully accept that there are a lot of people in Scotland who still want it, and I can understand why they still do. But I can't see the route. And unless they can create a sense that there is one and they're on that route, I think the next leader will be in trouble. It's always about the wider state of the party, not just a leader, when leaders fall speedily. So anyway, I could go on for ages about this, but there are a few opening reflections. No doubt we'll return to a big audience in Scotland. I'm anticipating a lot of questions about this in the weeks and months to come. But now, by the way, before all this happened, I was planning, oh God, so many other things to talk about. The fascinating pledge by the government to spend an additional £75 billion on defence by cutting a few civil servants. You know, I mean, they're sort of, because they want tax cuts, they can't really, and they want spending increases on a colossal scale. It is utterly bizarre, the tax and spend debate at Westminster. I was going to look at more at that Labour transport announcement, the railways announcement, which was really interesting, exciting in some ways, but raising many questions as well. And, so many things to be talking about. I was going to look at talk about leadership. Leadership has to have a kind of mystery and aura. And when a leader becomes demystified, they're in trouble. And I look at Trump in that court in the United States, seeing a figure become a rather pathetic human, sort of sitting in that windowless courtroom, looking tired and pathetic. And I wonder whether his followers, who had this irrational sense of him being a big figure, see that image and some of the irrationality goes. I merely pose it as a question. But now, over to your questions. And remember, to keep our never-ending debate in the cooperative going, it's steverick13@icloud.com. steverick13@icloud.com.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones. Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, last week in our never-ending debate, I think in response to a question from Paul Cooper, one of our regular writers, correspondents, I kind of praised the mayoral system, which I do think has led to improvements in public service delivery with their clear lines of accountability, rare in the public sector, rare in politics. But Stephen Townsley has written in with a very good point. He says, the problem with this is that not all mayors are created equal. In London, the mayor is scrutinised by an assembly, part of the assembly being elected by PR. This isn't true outside London. Instead, mayors face combined authorities of local council leaders. In fact, the mayor is the mayor of combined authorities. And then he looks at all the different powers, often weaker outside London, where actually they are pretty weak, say, compared to the mayor of New York as well. Yeah, very good point, Stephen. I think there needs to be a clarity and consistency and uniformity about who mayors are accountable to and for what, and they should be given more powers. Because, you know, it's very interesting with the run-up to the local elections, you know, there's quite a focus on the mayors, because in politics, let's face it, it is in the end easier to relate to an individual being held to account. And it is quite clear in London that a mayor would not survive if they muck up public transport. They've got to keep it good and affordable. And that really has led to improvements in public transport. Public transport in London was dire before the last Labour government introduced a London mayor. Dire, as bad as it is now in parts of the north of England, and I know how bad it is around there. And it will improve. Andy Burnham's got a bit of power, and when he over transport, when he uses it, it will improve, because if it doesn't, he'll be kicked out. But it's a very good point, Stephen, about the kind of messy way in which they're being introduced. White Van Man, Andy, is rightly despairing over the fact that the UK government rejected a mobility agreement with Europe to help young people travel and live abroad. This was going to be a reciprocal arrangement. So young people, like in those, do you remember those days when we were in the European Union, when you could travel around? But apparently we took back control, so we now have the power not to travel anywhere. But anyway, he also notes that this proposition to resume these freedoms for younger people was also rejected by Labour. And Andy says, we all know about the Ming vases and Daily Mail headlines, but this proposal is unequivocally a good thing, a positive progressive policy for the 21st century, and therefore worth backing for that reason alone. Or what is the point of Labour? They lack the confidence of persuasion on many issues, and especially Europe and Brexit. They would all be up for it, but they just are terrified of putting the case. Now, I can partly understand that. The media will say, you know, the Remainers are wanting this and this and this, betraying everyone. It'll all be insane, the reporting. And that's why I think you're right. There is space to put a case on these issues and find that it can be popular. Thank you, Andy. Good luck with the white van. Rob Roy from Charente in France. Enjoying the start of spring and listening to your excellent podcast when walking my dog. Oh, yeah, well, that's quite a romantic image, Rob. As my contribution to the never-ending debate at the cooperative, I was interested in your point that despite the clear failures of mistrust, she has still made some points and arguments in her book and interviews which deserve debate. One of these relates to the various non-governmental organisations, quangos, being unaccountable. Yep. This is a problem. The people who run, this is me talking, people who run quangos have a lot of power. Most people don't know who they are. And if you don't know who they are, they can hide behind obscurity. And if things go wrong, get away with it. Anyway, back to Rob. These seem to exist to allow off-balance sheet spending. Some of the quangos, that's right. Protect against political control. Yep. And establish centres of policy specialisation. Yeah, that's a positive case for it. It strikes me that it's highly beneficial to have such bodies sitting independent from government. But how can they remain democratically accountable? Well, yeah, it's a good question. And I think there are many ways in which you are absolutely right. You need specialists, and you need specialists to have some space to run things. But I think they need to be scaled up in terms of their prominence and accountability. I mean, I'll just give you one example. High speed rail. The people running high speed rail should have been, as part of the contract, compelled to give a monthly press conference to tell the wider world how they are spending every halfpenny, who they are employing, if costs are going up, why. And I think sometimes some of these people should appear in the House of Commons to answer questions. They can have outsiders. I know they go to committee meetings, but that's only about parliamentary committee meetings once a year. I think we've got to ratchet up massively the level to which non-elected people are held to account. Look at the post office, another example.
Hello, I'm Dorian Lynskey.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm in 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
Dan Mather from rural Dorset. I bet you're walking your dog, Dan, or having, you know, listening to podcasts in the midst of beautiful countryside or on the coast. You're also about this. Listening to your response to a question regarding the preference of Liz Truss over Sunak by the membership during the last Tory leadership contest, and your answer regarding that they preferred tax cuts in a smaller state. While that's largely true, do not overlook another aspect which sadly manifests itself in non-urban areas, that of race. A close friend of mine is a Conservative Party member and tells me that when attending party meetings in our local hall during the leadership process, many express negative sentiments regarding Rishi's heritage and that Truss, for all her faults, was at least proper British. It's horrifying, but a sad reflection of rural attitudes of some who don't have much contact with non-white people. Well, I still think I was asked that during the leadership contest as well, and I still think it was the Truss message that got overwhelming support amongst those members of magical tax cuts, which would in themselves lead to growth and provide money for public services effortlessly. But I'm sure that you're right that the fact that Sunak was non-white might have been a factor. I just don't know. I didn't hear or get any indication of that. You did, clearly. I think also now, in some parts of the country, it might be an issue. I don't think it's a fundamental one. It's about his party and the way he's decided to lead it, and indeed his own views, which, again, perfectly legitimate to have, but I think just outdated his worship at the altar of Thatcherism at a time when people are turning to the state. But I think it's out there as in the mix, depressingly so. Jeff Strange wonders whether I overstated the power of ideas in the battle to win elections and to stay in power when things go wrong. Jeff says maybe under a proportional representation system, that battle would matter more because you'd have different parties freer to put a case than these two big coalitions. I still think it matters, Jeff. If you look at how Thatcherism took off via Thatcher, it really was the power of ideas simply expressed about the state being stifling, and she would set people free by reducing the size of the state, and that kind of legitimized monetarism and all the other things that she did, privatizations. And there was no real counter. Jim Callaghan in the build-up 79, he wasn't interested in ideas, and he lost. So I think the battle of ideas does matter, but it perhaps would take a purer form under electoral reform. Although, of course, what happens afterwards an election is all done behind closed doors with these systems. Just maybe time for one more. Ed Bridges, thanks as always for podcasts. Oh, thank you. I started listening a year ago on the recommendation of my friend Wise Simon, and more recently have joined Patreon. Well, Wise Simon is very wise, Ed. I'm pleased he introduced you and to Patreon. My question is a specific one about Keir Starmer and his recent choice to come out on the side of the Premier League in relation to the proposed football regulator. I know that Starmer is an Arsenal supporter and so is perhaps not attuned to the views of the vast majority of fans in the country who watch grassroots football rather than the moneyed elite. But does he not realise how tone-deaf this seems? I, for my sins, have a season ticket at Newport County. Blimey, right. Well, I'm pleased you've got time to listen to the podcast as a contrast. And I'm in a lot of WhatsApp groups with other lower league and non-league fans, many of whom would not consider themselves political. Without exception, his words invoked howls of derision, best summed up by one comment. If he's prepared to take the side of rich football clubs and dump on poorer ones, it's likely he'll take the side of rich people and dump on poorer ones. Well, I thought I followed Keir Starmer inside out. I haven't followed his comments on football regulation. I suspect they are honed by his support for Arsenal and, but much more than that, the popularity of the Premier League. He wouldn't say a thing without reflecting on whether it would command support. But from what you say, Ed, is that the poorer clubs and the supporters of those poorer clubs feel discriminated against by the mighty followers of the mighty clubs in the Premier League, which is interesting. I can't comment more, Ed, because I haven't followed what he was saying about the Premier League and regulation. But thank you for making the point. So what a range. We've come a long way from the political crisis at the heart of the SNP and its wider ramifications for leadership and the challenges of leadership. What are the ingredients that enable a leader to cast their spell? And I'll tell you, one of them is an opinion poll lead of some significance. Hence, Keir Starmer doing so now, Alex Salmond, Nicola Sturgeon in the past. But anyway, lots of other ingredients too. We better stop here. It's one heck of a week in British politics. Do subscribe to Patreon and we'll get together on Friday. And if you can't make it, it will be recorded and put on the Patreon site for all of you to follow later over a glass of chilled white wine. And we will get together again very soon. Do book for King's Place Live at July the 10th. God knows where we'll be then, but we will delve deep. And thank you so much. Keep the questions coming. Sorry I haven't had time to get through many of them, but we're in the midst of rolling news here as I record this podcast. And see you all very soon. Take care. Bye.